Hello and welcome to Lost Steps with me, Malcolm Hopkins, coming to you courtesy of Resonance FM. If you've missed any of our previous episodes or any information on this programme or any others, please access our website, loststeps.org. Today I'm pleased to be joined by Simon Terrell. Simon, can I ask you the classic Lost Steps question? William Blake was first and last a Londoner. Simon, first and last a Londoner?
I'd like to say yes, but not exactly. I've lived here, I moved here permanently only in March of this year. I had a year here over 2008, 2009, and did live here for a couple of years as a child. So there's some evolving relationship there, but no, I guess I'm a newcomer.
Right. You're doing a project at Balfour and Estate. First of all, before we discuss that, can you talk briefly about what you define as crowd theory?
Oh, okay. Crowd theory, it's this project that I started in 2004, and it's this ongoing series of photographs where I essentially choose a location, some urban area. Most of these have happened in Australia. Research this area, invite everyone I can find who's got an association with that area to be at a certain place at a certain time, and then set up a large scene, a bit like a film set, lights, catering, a soundtrack, and invite people in there to choose how they want to represent themselves within this scene. And it's always people who've got an association with it. So it's essentially making a portrait of a place. And the crowd theory part of it is I'm really fascinated by this idea, a theoretical idea as much as anything, of the crowd as a kind of ultimate kind of social space. There's something that happens. I love that question, what's the difference between a group of people and a crowd? And there's something about a crowd space as what I see as a kind of this perfect social space where this kind of mixing happens. It doesn't happen in any other kind of environment. And all these sort of differences and ways that people relate drop away and something else happens.
Well, can you tell us a bit about the project you're engaged in at the moment?
Okay. At the Balfron Tower, which I moved into earlier this year, and I'm living on the 21st floor, I'm at the moment in the process of inviting all of the residents to be either on their balconies or in their windows or down in front of the tower on November the 18th. And again, I'm going to light the tower with film lights. There'll be a soundtrack catering this sort of thing, and just inviting everyone to choose how they want to represent themselves, and I'll make one single photograph of that.
And how do you build up your rapport with a community when you move into it? Because I assume there's a level of trust that needs to be built up for people to participate comfortably in these sort of activities.
Well, in one regard there is. In another regard, I guess, definitely I've spent a lot of time just hanging around. It's where I live, luckily, but just meeting people and talking to people and sort of suggesting this idea and seeing if people are interested. And so far, so good. We'll see what happens.
And are people comfortable with being engaging in these sort of activities, being photographed? I mean, I wonder if there's any age difference, because one of the things I was thinking about is young people now are quite familiar with mobile phones, reality shows and all this whole area of activity. I wonder, have you noticed any difference between an age response to it at all?
It's interesting. Not really, because somehow I think the kind of massing of a large group of people somehow takes away that immediate self-consciousness. So you're just sort of in amongst a group of people that you may or may not know, but that what I hope is that sort of, crowd familiarity means that people generally seem to be just there, quite comfortable.
Your work's based around the Balfron Tower. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit about the significance of the tower.
Well, I first was interested in the tower actually just through reading J.G. Ballard, and someone mentioned, I was familiar with High Rise, that book. Someone mentioned, Balfron Tower. You've got to see this place. I'm going there tonight. Why don't you come with me? And so I went along and I sort of couldn't believe it. I was so excited, and I just thought, I have to somehow find a way to do something here. And then subsequently I met Marcel Beattie, the director of Beaux Arts Trust, And through that meeting, a conversation evolved, and he offered me a residency there. And so it just sort of evolved. I didn't know at the start of this residency I would do one of these kinds of works, but it's just the sort of fascinatingly complex social space there. There's so much mythology associated with this tower. And the most interesting thing is the level, the way people who've lived there for a long time feel about it. This really interesting incredibly strong connection with the tower. Not always entirely positive, but that connection is there, and that's what I find most compelling about the whole thing.
And how many people have you encountered on the States who've lived their whole life on it?
There are a couple of people that have lived there since it was built. The caretaker, actually, he watched it being built in the late 60s. And there are a lot of people I've met who've lived there since the 80s. And the mood of this tower has changed so much since then, from something that, you know, had quite a reputation to, I guess now it's calmed down somewhat, but, you know, it's still got that
character. It's a listed building, isn't it? That's interesting. One of the things is, because you've worked in other parts of the world, and you've done a lot of work in Australia, I believe, are you familiar with those sort of estates? What I'm quite interested in is that, you know, if you were, are there estates like this in Australia? Have you worked in estates like that, or is it something that's, I don't know, new to you, that whole complex?
It is new to me. Where I've worked, one area I've worked in Australia a lot is a place, funnily enough, called Footscray, that is quite a similar, it's sort of to the East End, in that that's that first point of call for migrants, and it's one of those areas that's always changing and shifting, and former industrial, now it's sort of finding a new way to exist. But the estate, I've never lived in a high-rise before.
You've never lived in a high-rise? That's what
no.
I was getting at, yeah.
And
so what's your experience of that?
At first, I really didn't know what to make of it. It took quite some getting used to from where I've come from. I grew up in the suburbs of Australia, essentially. So it's a world away. It's another universe. But the more I know it, the more I love it, essentially. That view is incredible. The first thing in the morning is looking out the window and sort of essentially check if London is still there. Most of the time it is.
Because what I was quite interested in is on the estate, like lots of estates, you've got a high rise, right? You've got that, which is high. And then you've got the relationship between the tower blocks and the rest of the estate. Because I used to live in a high rise block. And of course, contrary to popular opinion, the estate was not just full of high rises. So you've got the high rise block, then you've got the lower and even lower ones. So you've got a relationship between the tower block, the rest of the estate, and then you've got the estate that then relates to the rest of London. Do you know what I mean? The environment around it. And I wonder how you see those fitting together in the area of the Balfron estate, how it all, you know, melds together, so to speak.
Balfron is in an estate called the Brownfield Estate. For one, an interesting sort of word to use for an area. But it is something. It's its own zone. There's a certain separation between that and its surrounding area, and it's so close to Canary Wharf, which is just, you know, so stark, that difference. But the thing about, I guess, the Balfron as well is it in that style of brutalist architecture, it feels like it's just been plonked in the landscape without any relationship essentially to what's around it. It's like this sort of massive sculpture in a way that you can walk into.
Because, I mean, one of the things I was conscious of when I lived in a tower block is that the area of public space, in the sense, you know, you're in your flat, which is a private space, and, you know, I lived on the 8th floor, then there's a sort of, you know, you go out into the floor, you're still part of that, which I suppose is semi-communal space, you get in the lift, and then you go down, then you've got the rest of the estate. So you've got this, almost like you've got your private, a semi-communal, and then a far more public space. You know, where do people meet each other on these estates and that sort of thing? I'd be interested to know how you found that there. You know, where is there a tenants association on it? How does the community, where does the community meet, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, the main place is the lifts.
Yeah.
There's a really interesting kind of lift etiquette, and I really like that. It's a really sort of contrary to what you would imagine. These lifts, which are these tiny little things, are often packed with people. That's the most communal area. The walkways and the foyer, not so much. There's outside is this sort of it's quite a windswept area of concrete walkways and fenced off grass areas. So that doesn't function as maybe it might have been intended. There's a couple of other sort of spaces. There's this wonderful Brownfield Social Club that's just reopened, beautiful old bar just at the foot of the tower. But essentially, yeah, there's not a whole lot of communal space.
I mean, talking about lift etiquette, that has actually just reminded me, because when I moved onto the Nightingale Estate, I went in there one day and there was this dog like waiting by the lift. I, you know, I thought, well, I got in and the dog got in. I thought, well, this is crazy. What am I supposed to do? You know what I mean? I'm not going to lock a dog. And then somebody came along and said, what are we going to do about the dog? And they just turned around and said, oh, it lives on the fourth floor, doesn't it? And I said, I didn't know. And they said, oh, yeah. And, you know, after a while, everybody in that tower block knew that the dog stood there. Didn't matter which floor you were going. You press button, you know, the fourth floor button. Yeah. The dog got out, barked. And that's, you know, that's... It's an interesting story about the way what appear to be demonised communities, tower blocks, were actually quite intimate. That's what I felt was quite interesting about it, because my experience with the tower block was actually quite positive. Whereas there's a lot... I mean, the tower block's become... I suppose it's become iconic and people have very different views about it. I mean, your experiences there, has that been positive?
It has, yeah. Contrary to all expectation, everything I've sort of learned beforehand is quite wrong. I think it's far more positive than it's been portrayed. And but I guess with the Bowfront in particular, there's a fantastic difference between the outside, this kind of aggressive structure in a way that's quite... It sort of pushes you away. And you feel incredibly self-conscious. I certainly did when I was first there, approaching the building, and then inside, something completely different. And in the lift etiquette, that is, you know, that's where I, you know, get to check in, say hello, see various people that I see, you know, frequently. And, yeah, it really has, it does a lot for that sense of familiarity.
I mean, what do you hope to get out of the project? What do you hope that the tenants will get out of it? That's one thing.
Yeah.
What do you hope... You know, you will learn from this project.
I'm most interested in just this idea of the tower, because it's been looked upon so much. And as you know, from those general ideas about tower blocks to the Bowfront in particular being the subject of so many sort of films and media depictions. And I'm interested in this idea of the tower having a chance to look back and so sort of reversing that gaze and seeing what happens. You know, I can't predict it. But and simply to make one picture is
and how that happens on one day.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk us through how that will actually work, the process of doing the one picture?
There's a call for people to meet around 5:30, 6 p.m. and then a soundtrack will start playing. Then over a period of just 1 hour, it's kind of like an hour ritual of making this photograph. There's a soundtrack. Then about every 5 minutes or so, there's a signal that a picture will be taken so people will know. Then that photograph is taken, and then there'll be another 5 or 10 minutes. We'll sort of set the camera again, do it again, take just 10 frames over that hour, pick one, throw the rest away, and then hopefully afterwards there'll be some kind of party down at the bottom.
I'm not sure how to phrase it, but there's some sort of, I don't know, almost ambiguity going on about representation and reality. Can you see what I'm getting at there?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see it as a sort of... the logic to me of it is that I don't want to introduce any elements that are not of the tower anyway, but it's just a heightened version of itself. So film lights and things just picking out what's already there, not bringing in... another view on it, because I don't... There's definitely ambiguity about this, because I, you know, there's no such thing as a completely objective picture. Of course, right, I'm bringing something to it, but I'm hoping to have the space of that picture open enough where the people in it really do define the narrative of that final image.
Because, I mean, hopefully what you do is you'll get the community, in a sense, to represent what it means to them, rather than what, I mean, I think what's happened in the past is lots of people have gone onto estates and they've had agendas.
Yeah.
You know, they've gone in looking for something. That's why it was quite interesting talking to you about your relationship with the estates, because when when I used to live on the estate, lots of people wanted to make films about them, and people sort of backed off because they felt that there wasn't going to be, A, they would have very little say in it, that's the first thing, and B, it would not be a true representation of their experience of the estate, because quite often people's experiences on these estates, it's very different to the way it was presented on, you know, documentaries, you know, don't go in there. So in a sense, you're trying to encourage the people to express their, the relationships they have on the estate and all that, the infrastructure that's important to them, rather than somebody coming in from outside and saying, this is a demonic place or whatever. Is that?
Yeah, it's exactly what I hope to do.
Yeah.
The residence board recently sort of had a survey whether they would ban all filming on the estate because of that very thing. They're sick of people coming in and, you know, doing exactly what you're saying. So, I mean, you know, for me, it's all about sort of just making that invitation. And if I get that bit right, hopefully it will, you know, what it will find a way to, you know, speak to the camera.
Can you imagine doing this project in Hampstead?
Well,
I mean, obviously you could do it, but I think eventually, what sort of differences do you think if you were to do it in Hampstead?
Oh, I think it would be entirely different. I think first thing is the whole, from past experience as well, probably a whole different, less complex environment. There's something that's so complex about this estate. There is the Trellick Tower, you know, the one that was built after the Balfron, perhaps. You know, I've sort of had that thought that it might be interesting to do a similar thing there and make a comparison. But again, I sort of see my job as simply the sort of technical side of setting up the situation, and then it's whatever happens, happens. So I can't, it's a fascinating question and I don't really know how to answer it.
No, I was just one of the things that I was thinking about when, you know, you were doing this, because I thought it was quite interesting. You know, like you say, the Trellick Tower would be a classic example to take, because they're quite similar and you could juxtapose it, and then you could go to something that's completely different, like Hampstead, and try to judge them. So how, I mean, how the process, there will be more than just this photograph, will there? Or is this just a photograph? Because, I mean, you're doing an exhibition, aren't you?
Yeah, essentially that, and the photograph is the main thing, but a series of drawings and other things that have gone to sort of into the making of it will be exhibited. Plus, you know, there may be, you know, documentation of the event, and there may be a series of interviews with residents. We'll see how all of that part of it goes.
So there's a possibility of creating almost like an archive, perhaps, about your experiences there.
Yeah, yeah. A certain sort of archive.
I mean, to go back to you know, your experiences in Australia, what are the, are there any differences that you think, you know, that London, working in here, has in London compared to Australia? You know, it's apart from the fact it's a completely different continent and all that sort of stuff, but, you know, things that you notice very much in terms of crowd theory and your area of activity.
The first thing that I was struck by when I got here in 2008 was I'd been on this thing for a while and I was obsessed with it, and, you know, London, crowded place, got here and just went, and my first thought was the other sorts of crowd pictures I do, more observational stuff, I just couldn't do here, because it struck me that in Australia, a crowd is the exception. There's something kind of perverse about a crowd in Australia with all this space. But in London, it's the norm. So it was just a sort of, it became immediately that literal crowd, quite sort of boring in a way. And so I set about making this series of pictures of erased crowds, because it was like the perverse moment in London is emptiness.
Yeah.
And so that was the first thing I discovered of a difference.
And the architecture is obviously different as well.
Vastly, yeah.
And do you find the way, because of we live in a crowded environment, as you'd say, I mean, whether it's Oxford Street, people going to football matches or whatever, well, like we were saying, you're coming on the tube this morning, how do you think that makes people's relationships different? You know, I mean, just actually sometimes just walking along a crowded street, it's quite difficult, isn't it, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole different level of negotiation, constant negotiation, that I sort of feel that it sort of just becomes part of your daily set of gestures here, which I think in an Australian city or suburb isn't necessary. And I think that feeds into this project in the way that I'm finding going about making this thing at the Battlefront. Whole new level of kind of negotiation and conversation with people that I didn't know how to anticipate.
So it's been quite a useful learning experience for you in that sense.
Ah, certainly. The learning curve is steep.
And, of course, the other thing that's interesting about tower blocks is, you know, the way they're built and that you've got a tremendous concentration of people there. I mean, I can't remember how many people were on the night. You know, I don't know, we had 21 floors, 4 flats, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people within an immediate vicinity so that you've got a crowd, in a peculiar level, you've got a crowd going up to the sky as opposed to the street sort of thing. So you've got all that area you can work with as well.
Absolutely. And I'm always amazed about how everyone manages to get on so well. And that, you know, it's always that thing, any crowded street, you know, we are so, in a way, we're so polite.
I mean, one of the things we have touched on already is the way tower blocks have been dealt with in the media and the way they've been demonised and changed. But, I mean, looking at the Battlefront Tower, what remains? The building, on one level, is the same building that went up, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
How have perceptions changed over the period? How have people interacted with it? How has it been changed by people?
It seems to me that the building's been through so many lives already since the 60s, and it's a fascinating question. I think about it all the time without any answer, but because it does seem like the building itself changes. But of course, you know, it's a static concrete structure, but the mood changes so dramatically, and I think, you know, people's ideas of it. The sort of the delicate balance of when it works so well, but it seems to a tower block, because of that compression, can so easily tip over into something that's a dystopian version of itself.
Which is what J.G. Ballard touched upon to a certain extent, and his reading has had quite an influence on the way people see these things. But I mean, one of the things that I remember is when I was growing up, you know, penthouses, the flats at the top of places like this were disarmed. You know, everybody wanted one. This was great. You got the few. It was something that people aspired to. Mm. And there seems to be a period where the tower blocks became demonised, which I don't actually understand, because obviously I lived in them. I had a great time there. Mm. Although where I lived, it was known as Fortress Nightingale, and people jokingly talked about this nightmare estate. The architecture can look intimidating. Mm. That's the problem with it. But the people who constitute the community, which are the important thing, when I was on the Nightingale Estate, there was a lot of my friends wouldn't step foot on it because they were intimidated by the architecture,
yeah,
which I think is quite strange. But the reality was something completely different. And this, perhaps you could just talk about this interplay between what appears to be an oppressive architecture, but somehow the people have then gone in, made it, humanised it in a sense. And they see it very differently. It's their home, basically, I guess.
And I think, I guess the first thing that I think about it in my own experience of living in this tower is that sort of first getting to know it. Well, it is my home. How do I, you know, essentially, I had to sort of figure out a new way of, and it is all just perception. Nothing about the tower has changed. But I, from not knowing how to be there, feeling extremely self-conscious and outsider, to now just figuring out that, well, it is my home, and being quite comfortable with it, more comfortable as time goes on.
But, I mean, how much do you think... Well, let's go back to J.G. Ballard. I mean, obviously, Ballard wrote a lot about this. When people weren't really addressing the issue, and there's a dystopian view about housing estates, tower blocks and that sort of thing. And in some cases, it's true. But I mean, I think a lot of the problems were social problems, the way they were used.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Goldfinger, the architect, would go on about, because he said that it's just a problem of how it's been managed. There's nothing wrong with my architecture. It's how you're using my architecture. And, you know, some very basic and quite easy things to do, putting in an intercom system. And I saw some plans that a man named James Dunnett, who worked with Goldfinger, I met recently, and he drew up some plans for a new concierge building at the foot of the Battlefront Tower, which hasn't been built. But again, that would change how the architecture is used completely.
And I mean, obviously, brutalism or whatever, however you want to describe this, has a sort of bad press. I mean, I don't know. It certainly had a bad press. Mm. You know, things architecture is a bit like lots of fashions. Things come and go and that sort of thing. But, I mean, the estate did go through a bad patch. I mean, a lot of the houses and estates went through a bad patch because they became, to a certain extent, a lot of the social problems, they just said, well, we'll put them all, like the Nightingale Estate, you know, it's a bit like, well, we're just going to put everybody there. And as you say, there wasn't really sufficiently management infrastructure there. It goes back to the thing, it wasn't the building that was a problem. I think, to be honest, it was caused by poverty, if you see what I mean.
It was poverty and bad management, or just neglect. Because these places, you know, they are. It's the compression, again. They take a certain degree of management that maybe perhaps just a normal sort of street of terrace houses doesn't.
And if, when you're speaking to the tenants, have they actually come up with any ideas that, you know, I mean, I know it's not part of your project, but they might have said, oh, this is improved because this has been done, or all we really need to do for this to make the tower completely accessible is this sort of thing.
Constant conversations around those sorts of things, because people have such strong opinions. You know, for example, in the Balfron, recently one of the two lifts has been breaking down, you know, every second day, things like that. But so there's always conversation about, you know, what needs to happen there. But I guess there's one thing that I must say, like in the way that it was conceived, what I do love about it is that scale of ambition anyway, whether it worked or not, that the architects of the time, it was what is fabulous to just think about what the level of what they were willing to attempt to do, whether it worked or not, you know, the jury's out on that. But, you know, well, actually, I personally think they have worked. I love it. But that's the most interesting thing to me about that kind of architecture.
Well, I think there's a desire for people to move back into high-rise, actually. And I think the reason I'm convinced it's to do with the problems of poverty in that is that actually, you know, somebody privatises an old tower block and, you know, they tart it up a bit, you know what I mean, blah, blah, blah. And suddenly you get all these people who want to buy into it. So it doesn't seem to be a problem of the architecture at all, does it?
Exactly.
It's the... I mean, basically, not to put too fine a point on that, they didn't want to mix with the people who were on the estate, to be quite honest. That seems to be the problem I've got with it. But architecturally, I think, I lived on it, had a great time, marvellous view over London.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was like a dream come true for me, and I look back on it with tremendous nostalgia. Regretfully, we're getting towards the end of the programme. So, first of all, I'll just sort of say, if you want to listen to any of our previous programmes, please go to loststeps.org. Perhaps you can just plug your event and tell our listeners how they can get involved, when the events are, the exhibitions and all that sort of stuff, so they can come along and how, if they want to, they can contact you, your website and everything.
OK. The main event has just happened, but there's an exhibition on at the Nunnery Gallery in Bow Road, opening on the 6th of January to the 26th. And there's more information on the website that is www.balfronproject.co.uk.
And I mean, can people contact you if they're interested in this? Do you have a...
Absolutely.
You have your own website, do you?
And my own website, just my name, simonterrell.com. And, I'd love it if people...
Yeah, so feel free to email. And can I say, Simon, thanks very much for coming along, and I hope your projects are a great success. Thanks very much.
Thank you.